Hello, it's Thursday 19th of August. I'm Hannah Pearson from Pear Anderson. On today's show, Gary Bowerman of Czech in Asia and I will discuss 2021, the year so far in ASEAN, in statistics. So let's get started. This is the Southeast Asia Travel Show.
Hello, wherever you are in the world, and thanks for listening in. So today's show is part 7 of our 2021, the year so far series. So far, we've produced an ASEAN overview, and we've spoken to local travel and tourism experts in Singapore, Vietnam, Laos, the Philippines, and yesterday, Malaysia. If you didn't catch that one, please listen to it. It's a crackerjack. So for today's special extra show, we've crunched the numbers and created a list of statistics that, when taken together, kind of sum up what a very difficult year it's been so far across Southeast Asia. So, Hannah, I guess we have to begin by looking at the kind of statistics that are at the root of all of our troubles, and that's COVID-19. So our number one statistic on today's show is
1.164 million, and that is the number of active cases in ASEAN currently. In terms of countries with the most, Indonesia tops out, like you would expect, 343,000. But do you know what? Malaysia and Thailand are not that far behind. Malaysia, 254,000. Thailand, 207,000. Even Vietnam is 175,000. So there are still a lot of countries across Southeast Asia with really a significant number.
Yeah, so those numbers have increased, particularly over recent months. It was the 22nd of July when the 10 nations together surpassed 1 million active cases for the first time. But actually, when you look at the numbers throughout August and you go back to the 29th of July, they haven't actually increased through this month. And that is mostly because the total numbers have fallen in Indonesia, the official numbers anyway, which at one point you said there, Hannah, they're up to 343,000 active cases. That actually went over 500,000 at one point, and that's come down quite considerably. But you're right, picking out those worrying countries which remain, Malaysia, Thailand, and Vietnam, they are by far away ahead of every other country. Even Philippines is 105,000, which is relatively low when you look at its population and the number of total cases that it's had. Just kind of shows that at the moment, the situation remains pretty difficult throughout the region. And I guess one of the points also, Hannah, is there's no COVID-safe pockets of the region anymore.
No, you know, last year we kept saying a lot of countries across Southeast Asia were pretty safe. They had very, very little cases. But even countries like Brunei now, which, you know, had, I think, zero locally transmitted cases for months and months and months, had their first locally transmitted cases last week. So even Brunei, Timor-Leste, which again had done pretty well in controlling the pandemic. And these are countries we don't tend to talk about very much on Southeast Asia Travel Show. Well, I mean, because they're fairly small. You know, even these strongholds against COVID have fallen, haven't they, down to this Delta variant.
Yep, they have. And so we're hoping that one of the reasons that the active case numbers are relatively stagnant right now, and we're hoping that they will start to go down, is because of vaccinations, which have started to ramp up in some parts of the region. So our key statistic, which we've got from Our World in Data, is 71%. So Singapore currently has 71% of its population is fully vaccinated, which, you know, that's moving up towards 3/4 of the eligible population, which is great news for them. Cambodia ranks second in the region currently with 45% of its population is fully vaccinated. And Malaysia, which is accelerating quite fast, is currently on 35% and is looking to get to 50% in the next few weeks. Beyond that, the figures aren't great. The actual overall average for Asia is 25%. So it shows there's huge differentials across the region. But if you go after Malaysia, which, as I just said, is 35%, the next best after that is Laos, which is 20%. So, you know, there's a huge difference. Indonesia obviously has such a huge population, only has 11% of its population fully vaccinated. There's a lot of work still to do.
Yeah, absolutely. Some of those big, big countries. And again, it is because they are big countries. You know, we're talking 100 million. Indonesia is what, 280 million, 290 million? I always forget, but a lot of people. So, I mean, if you looked at like the absolute number of doses that, say, Indonesia has given, it would blow many of the other ASEAN countries out of the water in terms of the actual number. But in terms of the share of the population, unfortunately, that remains pretty low.
Yeah. So we'll move to our next statistic, which is zero, Hannah. It is zero. Now, why have we chosen zero? Now, that's because this term COVID zero, which has become this catch-all term, which the media tends to use when it's describing the strategy of Asian governments when it comes to the pandemic. There was one example a couple of days ago in the South China Morning Post, and the quote said that a zero tolerance policy, which Asia has doggedly pursued, is unworkable and unsustainable. Now, the problem with that is that some countries, yes, have had a zero tolerance policy, but across the region, that's simply not true. Countries are just fighting, they're firefighting. And so a zero tolerance policy doesn't really explain why we have all these lockdowns and these travel restrictions. It's just that the Delta wave has been so brutal throughout the region. So I thought we'd have a look at, in terms of which countries would we say, Hannah, actually have a zero COVID policy?
That's a good one. So, I mean, in Southeast Asia right now, I would say there are probably only two countries that are still perhaps pursuing this COVID zero strategy. And one of those is Brunei and the other is Laos. Though, I mean, we may end up seeing Laos kind of changing on that. And we were discussing that with Jason Rowland in our episode 2021 year so far in Laos a few weeks ago, in that could change because Laos is now seeing, you know, more prolonged locally transmitted cases. But Brunei, like we said, it had no locally transmitted cases until last week after a long period. So it'll be interesting to see if that shifts. But in the rest of the region, there's very much this resignation, this acceptance that zero COVID just doesn't work.
Yeah, I'd say beyond the region, Singapore tends to get lumped into that zero COVID. But I think that's false. It hasn't been able to achieve zero COVID, and right now it's obviously saying that that's not its strategy. It's looking more towards living with the future of COVID. Across the region, countries that have also really touted zero COVID, I guess, would be China for sure, New Zealand definitely, Australia, Hong Kong, yes, Taiwan, Macau, perhaps some of the Pacific Islands, but you know, the problem with this catch-all COVID zero term is it doesn't really zone in on some of the specific circumstances in some of those countries. And the policies tend to reflect those. So, you know, just lumping Asia together as a zero tolerance policy region is misleading totally.
Yeah, absolutely. So we'll move on to another zero. And that is the number of travel bubbles that are still functioning in Southeast Asia and APAC.
Yeah, there aren't any, are there? I mean, until recently, the only real two-way bubble that was working was Australia and New Zealand. That's currently suspended. New Zealand has also yesterday, I think, suspended its travel bubble with the Cook Islands. And there's another number in there related to travel bubbles, which is two, Hannah. What does that relate to?
Number two, yeah. The number of times the Hong Kong-Singapore air travel bubble has failed. So, of course, we saw it fail in November last year. We saw it fail again when Singapore had its most recent wave of cases. And, you know, I think I've said this before on the podcast, I've got my doubts that this one is going to come off. What do you reckon?
What, for number three?
Yeah, I don't think there's going to be a number three.
It's kind of hard to know because the two nations seem to have sort of diverged in their objectives and the way that they're looking at this. You know, Hong Kong really is, its priority is the border with mainland China. Singapore is looking to, it's being very, very cautious, but it is looking to develop links with other countries around the world. I mean, we discussed when the Hong Kong-Singapore air travel bubble was first promulgated, which, what's that? It's almost a year ago now, isn't it, when it was first discussed. It didn't ever seem to really be a particularly good fit. You know, the air travel and the passenger travel between those two destinations previously wasn't that great. It wasn't that high. There was a lot of business travel and there's a lot of family and friends that live in each other's countries. But in terms of actual tourism, the numbers were relatively low. But it did seem to be at the time a way to try and galvanize both the big airlines in those two countries and the airports, of course, both Changi Airport, which we'll come to in a minute, and Hong Kong International Airport are two of the region's biggest, busiest and most important airports. So it was trying to drive traffic through those. But in terms of the actual two-way traffic between Hong Kong and Singapore, it didn't really seem to be a very strong raison d'etre, did you think?
No, exactly. I think at the time, you know, perhaps it would have served a purpose, but perhaps now, you know, travel opening up more, Europe has opened up, perhaps there's less of an urgency, less of an impetus to choose Hong Kong as one of the first partners. But let's see, right? It could all change.
Yeah, that's also true. So as we mentioned, probably 10 months ago, the Hong Kong-Singapore air travel bubble was probably the biggest story in travel and tourism in the region, but that's been overtaken in 2021. The biggest story is the Phuket sandbox, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, how many times have we written or said the word sandbox this year? I think that's something
for the first time in our lives.
Exactly, but it's common parlance now. But yeah, I mean, so we can't talk about 2021 and statistics without having a quick look at the latest statistics for the Phuket Sandbox. So the Phuket Sandbox, total visitors so far, so it opened on the 1st of July, up till the 17th of August, it has had 21,955 visitors. So not really something to shout out about. But, you know, on the other side of things, it is still running. And given the current state of tourism and COVID in Thailand right now, that in itself is pretty impressive, I think.
Yeah, I would agree with you there. Not hugely impressive, but also I don't think much of a surprise. Two of the problems that we've said over time about the Phuket Sandbox was one, you know, its source markets just are not able to reach it. You know, most of its Asian source markets for Thailand cannot travel to outbound at the moment. There are very few air connections, and so they're really relying on long-haul markets. Problem with focusing on long-haul markets, particularly Europe, North America, is they don't tend to travel to Southeast Asia at this time of the year. That tends to be during the winter period for the Northern Hemisphere, so Christmas and New Year. So, you know, Thailand has, right from the beginning, said that it was trying to build up momentum for Phuket Sandbox so that it would try and have stronger visitor numbers between December, January, February, and March. The problem with that also is you look at the forward booking numbers and they're not particularly impressive. And I think there are a number of reasons for that. One, obviously, as you said there, Hannah, is concerns about the COVID situation in Thailand. I think there's also concerns in Europe and North America about whether they will also be able to travel long haul during the winter, because they're not quite sure how numbers in their own countries are going to roll out after this summer. And also the actual access, you know, how many airlines will be providing routes, regular routes into Phuket or other destinations in Thailand that would actually help boost demand. There are a number of problems which have actually emerged during the last month and a half that show that Phuket was brave in doing this. I don't think there's any doubt about that. And it was a bit of a kind of standard bearer for trying to reopen tourism. But some of the problems that it encountered would be the same for anybody that was trying to open up in the region right now.
Yeah. And I think especially you make that point about worries about COVID-19. And this is something, you know, that Thailand, the TAT, tourism stakeholders have been trying to fight, haven't they? They've been trying to say, well, look, we want to be, you know, we want Phuket to be seen as separate from Thailand, but it's almost a futile struggle, I think, to be able to convince countries around the world to keep track of two different statistics for one country and, you know, make two different judgments about different parts of the country, which bit's safe, which bit's not safe. Yeah, it's a hard sell, definitely.
Yeah, so another related statistic to that is 120. So originally, before the Phuket Sandbox actually began, when it got the official sign off, the Thai Prime Minister said that he was looking to reopen the entire country of Thailand within 120 days. So that would be, what, the end of October. That clearly isn't going to happen right now.
No, I think that was perhaps a pipe dream then. And I mean, certainly cases weren't as high as they were now. And I think Thailand was probably banking on having a much faster rate of rollout for vaccines, perhaps, than they had now, because of course that's the other condition to being able to reopen the country, is to have, you know, vaccinated 70% of the population by that point. And it's become very clear by now that that might just be a dream, I think, to be able to reach that percentage of vaccination by end of October.
Yeah, I agree. And that impacts Thailand's projections, because as we do know, Thailand does love to project tourism figures, which initially for the year were going to be 3 million inbound visitors. That has fallen down to the Tourism Authority of Thailand recently saying that it will be a maximum of 1 million. The fiscal authority of Thailand is going much, much lower. That's saying 300,000. But they're upping the figures for 2022, aiming for 12 million.
You've got to love Thailand. You've got to love a forecast from Thailand. You can just pick whatever number you like, I think, and that's your forecast for inbound travel.
Yeah, I agree. But then you look at, you know, next year's projection, 12 million, that sounds a lot, doesn't it? But 2019, how many did they have?
I think 39 million, wasn't it? So,
yeah, 39.9 million.
Yeah, so 12 million, yeah, is just a fraction of that. If they could even get that, it will go a long way to kickstart the tourism industry.
Yeah, which kind of throws up a couple of issues. One, obviously, Thailand was the most visited country in Southeast Asia in 2019. And you would presume that it would, you know, be one of the most visited countries again when the recovery starts. Will it be? Will other countries usurp it? Will other countries take some of its previous tourism demand? We don't know yet. We have no idea. But you get the feeling that by projecting 12 million visitors for next year, Thailand doesn't have great confidence in the ability of its tourism industry to rebound quickly.
That's true. Yeah, that's a really interesting way of looking at it, yeah. So shall we move to a different sphere now and talk about airlines and aviation?
Let's do that. And let's talk about what we think is probably the most important airport in the region, you know, for connectivity, connecting East and West, connecting Australasia, but also connecting Asia Pacific.
Yep, Changi Airport, our favourite airport, right?
Definitely.
So they released some stats, and from January to June 2021, it had just 951,000 passenger movements. I mean, you compare that to 2020, that was 12.03 million. 2019, 68.3 million. This is a massive, massive drop. And like you say, you know, I think the 68.3 million shows just how key the airport was, and it's probably still pretty impressive that it's reaching 951,000 in the first half of this year, given that it's got no domestic flights, right? These are all international flights.
Yeah, absolutely true. And it's connectivity. You're absolutely right. It's you know, Singaporeans themselves aren't traveling very much, so most of those would be connecting different destinations. You're right. It's less than a million total passengers across 6 months for Singapore Changi Airport is just, you know, if anybody had told you that 2 years ago, you'd simply just wouldn't believe it. That's less than a 12th of what the figure was in 2020. The reason for 2020's numbers, as we know, is that January 2020 was actually a record January month for the airport. It did really, really well. Big numbers as well in February and also into March. But as soon as the COVID lockdowns came, obviously that impacted the rest of the year. But this year just hasn't really got going. But, you know, as you say, 951,000 compared to other major airports in the region, it would be, you know, it would be higher than most of them.
And so we can't talk about Singapore Changi Airport without talking about Singapore Airlines. And they, of course, like we just said, no domestic flights. So their net loss for 2020-2021 financial year, which they announced in May, was 4.3 billion Sing dollar net loss. Passenger traffic down 97.9% on the previous year. You know, when you see these statistics, you think, wow, it's amazing that this airline is still standing. But of course, they've had a lot of support from the Singapore government, who don't want to see them go bankrupt.
One of the interesting things is, you know, again, if somebody had suggested that to you 2 years ago, that passenger traffic will be down 98% and that the, you know, one of the region's most important airlines would have lost 4.3 billion Singapore dollars, you'd have said that was crazy. It just shows you two things. One, just how devastated the whole region has become, the whole economies. But secondly, I think just how we've become inured to some of these figures. You know, we're regularly becoming used to 90% plus drops in travel, in airline passengers, in hotel occupancies, that kind of thing. And also these multi-billion dollar losses from some of the biggest players, which, you know, going forward into the future, as you mentioned there, Hannah, Singapore Airlines has been able to recapitalize. That's really, really important. But it just shows you that even so, having done that, it will be a slimmed down airline. Its operations will be much less than they were before the pandemic. And that's also showing, isn't it, in their current forecasts?
Yeah, exactly. So right now they are forecasting that by the end of September, they will have reached about 33% of its pre-COVID capacity. So, I mean, 33% for them, given the past year, is pretty high. But you know, 33% of pre-COVID capacity still end of September, 1.5 years on. Yeah, it's pretty gloomy. I guess that they are basing this optimistic, if we can call it optimistic forecast, on the fact that Singapore is tipped to reopen its borders once it hits that 80% vaccination rate. And therefore, people are going to be wanting to travel out or travel into Singapore.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, that's only 33% of its actual passenger capacity. That's not the total passengers it'll actually be carrying, because a lot of those planes will be nowhere near full. So let's sort of extend from that, from Singapore Airlines into the rest of the region. And according to OAG, Southeast Asia's scheduled airline capacity, this is an astonishing figure, operated at minus 77.3%. That's across the region, against the week of 20th of January 2020. So just before the pandemic struck, minus 77.3% across the region. Now, that's the worst of the 17 submarkets around the world that OAG monitors. The next worst is Southwest Pacific, which includes Australia and New Zealand, and that's minus 63.1%. Beyond that, the next worst is Southern Africa, which is minus 55.0%. And the fourth worst is Lower South America, which is minus 45.8%. But when we look at that headline figure, Hannah, minus 77.3% of scheduled air capacity in Southeast Asia, it's a really long road back, isn't it?
It is. And I think this just shows, because it's not only international tourism that isn't open. Of course, borders are closed nearly across the region. But it's domestic tourism as well that has still not reopened, that is still stopped across the majority of these countries. Like you say, it's going to be a long road to getting back to even minus 45%. That would be pretty nice, wouldn't it?
Yeah, and that's reflected. There's a really good point there about domestic. That's reflected in the individual country figures, isn't it, Hannah?
Yeah, so 2 weeks ago, Malaysia was minus 92.8% down versus the 20th of January 2020 week. The worst hit, minus 92.8%. Thailand's not much better, minus 84.8%. Singapore, minus 82.9%. Even Philippines and Vietnam, both around minus 75%. And when you look at those numbers, you really realize nothing is moving.
Yeah. And really, Vietnam, I think, is kind of the highlight. I mean, we've been saying, Hannah, for months, you know, Malaysia's had no domestic travel pretty much all year. So the figures aren't that surprising. But you look at Vietnam, minus 74.7%. You know, earlier in the year, that was up, I think, among the top 10 countries worldwide for scheduled air capacity, simply on the basis of its domestic air sector, which was doing really well earlier in the year. You know, we spoke to Mike Tatarski a couple of weeks ago, and he said that, you know, earlier in the year, he was traveling around, people were traveling quite freely. But it's dropped. It's fallen really, really badly over the last few months. And Vietnam obviously is struggling right now.
Yeah, I mean, and, you know, Vietnam specifically, the Hanoi-Ho Chi Minh City route pairing, that was one of the busiest in the world. Right now, only one flight per day is permitted to fly between them because of the pandemic situation. I can't see Vietnam's numbers in terms of air capacity getting any better until really they lift some of these very prohibitive lockdowns that they've imposed in the country.
Yeah, and when you look at those sort of macro figures, minus 92.8% of scheduled air capacity for Malaysia, and then you look at its actual impact on individual airlines, you know, AirAsia Malaysia has said that it actually 90%, so 9 out of every 10 planes that it has of its fleet is currently grounded.
Yeah, exactly. You look in Indonesia, Lion Air announced that it will have to furlough 8,000 employees. Things are not looking good. And the only anomaly you really see in Indonesia is Super Airjet, which is the latest low-cost airline, which launched its inaugural flight just last week. Other than that, really, we're not seeing any growth in the aviation sector. It will be interesting to see what their plans are, deciding to launch during a pandemic with all these restrictions in place.
Absolutely. And as we spoke yesterday with Faiz Fadlila about Malaysia, he was saying that he was hoping that in the fourth quarter of this year, that the new government in Malaysia, when that is actually formed — we don't currently have a government — will look to reopen its air sector, because it will have to. And, you know, we could see a bit of a surge in the fourth quarter to bring that 92.8% figure right down.
Gosh, let's hope so. Else I think we're going to see a lot more redundancies across airlines if those kind of numbers continue, especially without government support.
Yeah, absolutely. And into 2022, you know, this hopeful rebound, that would be severely impacted if airlines don't have the staff and the planes and the capacity to be able to deliver a recovery. So number seven, that's an interesting figure. Hannah, you came up with this one. You put this on the list. Seven for Thailand. What does that mean?
So seven is the number of Thai airlines who joined up together to create the Airlines Association of Thailand. And basically, there wasn't really an association for airlines prior to this. I think with very fierce competition, perhaps they felt that there wasn't that need. But because they are so lacking financial support from the government, they decided to group together to lobby basically the government for this financial aid, for these soft loans that were promised to them last year, I think, by the government, and who are still delaying and delaying in giving these soft loans to them. And we've seen, you know, Thai Air Asia has just simply stopped flights for the month because of all of these. They just can't afford to pay their staff salaries. They're even delaying paying parts of their staff salaries until September. These airlines desperately need help. And I think it's interesting, we have seen, I think that when we were talking to Phuket Hotels Association as well, this banding together of travel associations, of the private sector, to really work together and try to find solutions. And I think that at least is some small positive that is coming out from the pandemic, a more collaborative approach, I think, towards tourism.
Yeah, and born out of absolute necessity. You mentioned the Phuket and the Thai Hotels Association said, now this is an incredible statistic, Thailand, remember this is Thailand, you know, the most visited tourism country in the region. In October, its hotel occupancy across the country was 6%. 6%. And it actually surveyed its members, and it said that 38% of hotels were open during the month of June 2021. But if 38% were actually open and occupancy was just 6%, you can imagine that they just virtually had no guests at all.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose that you would get to the point really of thinking, well, what is the point of us even being open? Maybe we should just close long-term, reopen back in 2022 and see what the situation is. And I think lots of other tourism businesses across the region have done the same. So again, there was an ASITA survey in Indonesia that found 30% of travel agents had closed. You know, these are big numbers, and a lot are closed, maybe temporarily, but as things drag on and on and on, you really get to that point where you're staring at the wall and just say, maybe just cash in my chips now rather than hang on.
Yeah, Felice Axelam, we were talking to last week in the year so far in Philippines, said that, you know, a lot of travel agents, she said most, I think, had just kind of accepted that they've got to ride this out. They can't. There's going to be no business. They've just got to wait for whenever it is that the Philippine tourism industry picks up again. And that could be in 2022 at some point.
Exactly. So I've got another number for you, Gary, and that's 28 days. Any guesses what 28 days refers to?
Only because you told me, I would not have guessed this one, but it's pretty scary figure, isn't it? I mean, if there's any figure that is actually going to be a disincentive to any kind of travel in future, it's this one. So why is that?
It's the length of mandatory quarantine in Laos. And it's a bit of a strange one, actually, because it's almost the same week that Laos doubled its mandatory quarantine period for returning travelers to 28 days. Vietnam halved its quarantine period. So we have seen all sorts of experiments, haven't we, across the region this year. So from 28 days, Singapore had 21 days for quite a long time. We've seen 14 days, 10 days. The Phuket sandbox were 0 days if you're fully vaccinated. And now this new Phuket sandbox kind of extension, 7 plus 7 days. So you can spend 7 days in Phuket, and then you can spend 7 days in another part of Thailand, and then you can go off on your way. But it's just kind of amazing, isn't it? The differences between different policies of these governments.
It's amazing. And I think it's absolutely incredibly frustrating and bewildering in many ways. You know, what is the science behind this? What is the science behind a 28-day quarantine? What is the science behind a 14-day, a 10-day, a 7-day? How can different countries have these? There was the case, not in Southeast Asia, but in Australia recently, where Tokyo Olympians coming back to Australia, they were heading back to South Australia state. They had to transit via Sydney. So transiting via Sydney meant a 14-day quarantine, and then you go to South Australia and you have another 14-day quarantine. So it's 14 plus 14 is 28 days. It makes absolutely zero sense. If you do a 14-day quarantine entering a country, that should be sufficient. But we are moving now towards the era of vaccinated travel. And as we've seen in most of Europe this summer, the quarantine requirements have been either dropped or significantly reduced, or you can do them at home. The only way to restart travel in Southeast Asia is simply to get rid of quarantines, because 28 days, what's the point of having that? It isn't going to work. Nobody's going to actually endure 28 days of quarantine. So why would you have it?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it was interesting because after Singapore ran that 21-day quarantine, and they imposed that specifically because of that Delta variant, and that at the time it was spiking in India, and they were very, very worried about these variants of concern. You know, they ran all of the stats on it, and they came out afterwards and they said, well, the reason why we reduced it back down to 14 days was that we found that we caught all of the cases within those 14 days. You know, there were none that were detected after 14 days. So we just said, well, what's the point in having 21 days? Let's shorten it. But you're right, travel can't restart until there's no quarantine. And unfortunately, it still looks like many Southeast Asian governments and countries are not willing to really make that step, are they?
Yeah, I think it comes down to the point now. I mean, you're absolutely right. 28-day, 21, even a 14-day quarantine really is a road to nowhere. It simply isn't going to have any effect on rebooting travel. So governments are going to have to be upfront and honest going forward about what they want. If they want travel, then they have to be prepared to reduce significantly or remove the quarantine requirement. Without it, you're simply not going to have any travel. Mostly people are doing quarantines because they have to, whether they're traveling to visit friends and family, whether it's for work purposes. But in terms of rebooting leisure travel, quarantines simply aren't going to work. So governments have to be honest. If you do want travel, you have to get rid of quarantines. If you don't want travel, be upfront and say that, but don't use a quarantine as a kind of shield to hide behind.
Well said. And on that point, I think that probably brings us to the end of today's show. 2021, the year so far in ASEAN in statistics. We hope you enjoyed the podcast, and don't forget to send us your thoughts or comments on what we discussed or what we missed out. You can drop us an email at hello@theseasiatravelshow.com or message us on our LinkedIn page at the Southeast Asia Travel Show or Twitter at SEA Travel Show.
You can catch up with the Southeast Asia Travel Show's full back catalogue, including all of our previous 2021, the year so far podcasts on our website, www.theseasiatravelshow.com, or on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Pocket Cast, Podchaser, Castbox, Overcast, Podcast Addict, Stitcher, and now Amazon Music. Just search for the Southeast Asia Travel Show on each app. And remember, if you do listen to us on Apple Podcasts, please rate and review us, because that helps other people to find the show.
That's a wrap for today. Next week, our 2021 The Year So Far in ASEAN series stops over in Indonesia with Julia Winterflood. We're looking forward to that one, and see you again soon.